Radio on 88.9 FM. It's about 24 minutes to 8 o'clock.
We've got Craig Isherwood from the Council Electoral Council. Citizens of Electoral Council. Craig, good morning. How are you doing? Thanks for coming on to Radio Skid Row.
Yeah, thanks, Jock. Jack. I think pretty good, thanks.
I've got Harrowood and Shart here. Can you explain to us, Craig, about the Citizens Electoral Council? We've seen a lot of in rallies. You've got a website as well coming up. And could you explain what is the Citizens Electoral Council?
Well, Jack, we've been around for 23 years as a registered political party. We stand candidates at election and these sorts of things. We're an activist party because we actually are fighting for the sovereignty of our country as opposed to the takedown under globalisation and free trade. And I think we're extremely well known in this country, particularly amongst the leadership layers, because we're associated with statesman and physical economist Lyndon LaRouche in the United States. Mm-hmm. Back in 1991, I was personally responsible for bringing a lot of Mr. LaRouche's ideas into Australia because Mr. LaRouche has played a crucial role for the last 50 years in fighting the policies of globalisation, of free trade, privatisation and all these nation-busting type policies. So we've been very active, full-time here in Melbourne since 1991, and we have thousands of activists around the country. That we're not a protest movement, which makes us a big difference from the other protest movements you see around. Mm-hmm. We're actually an organisation that says, look, in order to promote the solutions, you actually have to understand a lot more about history, about science, about the arts and so forth. So the solutions come from what we call creativity. Human beings are innately creative. Yep. And that then leads to, if you foster it through funding decent education, decent health, and actually looking after your citizenry, you actually fund scientific and technological development, you can solve an enormous number of the problems that we have on the face of the planet today.
Interesting. And education, what would you say with the education? The education system is indoctrinated for business. What would you say about the education?
Well, the type of education system that people need is what's called classical education, where you're not just given a book or a textbook and said, learn this and then be able to regurgitate it, but you actually have to develop your mind in order to make discoveries of the principles of how this universe works. Like, for example, you can't see gravity, right? You see the effects of gravity, like something falling off a tree, the famous example of so-called Newton's apple falling and hitting him on the head, therefore he discovered gravity. That's not gravity at all. What you see is the effects. You don't actually see physical principles. You can only discover those by looking at the somewhat confusing effects of these physical principles. Now, real science, real education, looks at the physical principles that are unseen by the senses and actually determines what are these unseen forces that govern the universe. And that's actually what real science is. That's what real education tries to get at.
I've just got a question for Christopher. Craig.
Mm-hmm.
I really like what you're saying. I really like what your organisation does on a lot of levels. But I just want to know what you think about what is our role as people who have actually started thinking and started, developing our critical thinking capacity and looked into a lot of what's going on in the world, geopolitics, science, and seen a lot of deception and a lot of disinformation. Do you think our role is to basically start educating the ones who don't understand it yet? And what's the best way to do that? Because, we come up against a lot of very blinkered thinking, for example, in the area about questions about climate change, where people just start speaking back to you something about consensus, and they say, well, there's scientific consensus, and then they'll say, well, you're not an expert, you can't have really an opinion because you're not an expert, you're not a scientist, and we've got to go with the consensus. The consensus is that the world is burning up because of man-made carbon dioxide, therefore we've got to have a carbon tax, that's the mentality of the herd thinking that makes people gravitate to that, and it can be very hard to get the alternate opinions through.
Well, that's what we find, because you do have this popular opinion mentality in the population, right? You've got to go along to get along. that you have to agree with consensus. Now, interesting thing about science, a true scientist never, ever accepts consensus, because a true scientist is always looking for the paradoxes, the different, the things that we can't explain is what science is about. So when you have this complete, disgusting debate on climate change and the need for a carbon tax, what you find is this idea, the consensus, the science is settled. That's what they're telling us, the science is settled. Mm. What absolute rubbish. Mm. I mean, you look at where the Earth sits. Just draw this picture out for your listeners. Mm. The Earth sits, a small ball, inside an incredibly destructive, powerful, energetic solar system, which in turn sits inside an enormous energy mass in the galaxy. Of that galaxy is one of billions of galaxies. Now, we're bombarded by cosmic radiation, by all these forces. Unfortunately, over the period of many billions of years, our Earth itself, because of the principle of what we call life, and I've done a lot of work on Vladimir Vernadsky, who's a great Russian biogeochemist that developed the fact that our Earth is governed by the principle of life, actually. Mm-hmm. And what you find is that we're ignoring science actually today, not real scientists, they're actually shut out, they can't be heard. But we're ignoring, by the policies that we're taking on, the fact that we're moving into another one of the 62 million year extinction cycles that we've had many, many of in the course of the life of the Earth. And one of those, the last great extinction cycle was what's called the KT cycle, which saw the destruction of the dinosaurs. Now, because of the position of the Earth within our solar system, but because of the solar system's position within the galaxy, we're moving into a system, into a position above the plane of our galaxy, whereby we're going to be bombarded by a lot more cosmic radiation. Now, these sorts of discussions aren't even being brought up in terms of serious science, because the idea is that what we're hearing in the Senate, what we're hearing, the fact is that they're going to pass this carbon tax, this is not a scientific discussion. This is a political discussion and has first and foremost got to do with population reduction. The intention by the British Empire through the monarchy personally is to reduce the world's population from 7 billion down to below 1 billion. And you had Joachim Schellenhuber come down here. This guy was effectively knighted by the Queen for putting forward policies in science that would reduce the world's population down below 1 billion people. Now, you asked the question about educating the population. Well, that's why we're in politics. That's why I started the Citizens Electoral Council 23 years ago. There's a lot of infomaniacs out there. People love information. They just soak it up. Oh, what opinion? What's your opinion? The question is, what do you do with that information? Well, you have to start from a position of, well, what does your life mean? What are you prepared to fight for as an individual? And I made the decision with my wife to start a political party that was going to fight for the sanctity of human life, fight for the development of peoples everywhere, and particularly this power of creativity in the individual. So therefore, you have a stance, you have a position, actually a philosophical position, whereby you can then determine what is truth and what's not. And the basis of that truth is, how does what I understand to be truth develop the human race for a start, but actually stand the test of real tests, right? How does it promote human life? How does it promote human society? Because, as I said, you have this political force in the world. It's called the British Empire, and people say, oh, the British Empire doesn't exist anymore. Well, of course it does, but it exists in a different form. It exists in a form of monetarism, of this international financier oligarchy that is running the world's financial system. So we have a complete dominance in the world today of a financial system is destroying nations. Now, that's what the British Empire is. And just the other day on 60 Minutes, last Sunday, there was a woman being interviewed there, an actor, who's a dame of the British Empire, and they use the same terms. So it's not like the British Empire doesn't exist, it's not known to exist, it's just been a little bit politically incorrect to talk about the empire for the last 50 or so years. So in terms of educating people, like I say, we come across a lot of infomaniacs who just love to soak up information, but it means nothing for the human race. It means nothing for our society and the direction of our society unless you're prepared to put that into action. And that's why we established a political party called the Citizens Electoral Council and have a network of many thousands of people to say, well, I've got to do something about what's going on. Now, we're not heard about much in the media. Because if we were put on the media, you would begin to hear an alternative voice that actually speaks the truth. That we're not interested in having a debate about facts. We'll talk about what's the political truth about where is the world going.
Yeah, we'll go on to the
connection between CEC and Lyndon LaRouche?
Okay, well, back in 1988, I and a number of people established a political party that was fighting for the principles of sovereignty, particularly national sovereignty for our country. 1988 was after the 1987 stock market crash. We saw all sorts of things happening in our country that saw our sovereignty being destroyed at that point. So we said, we've got to do something about this. So we started a political party. Had no real idea what we were doing, but said, look, we've got to stand up and fight for this. And we actually won a seat in Baramba. Now, we were very populist in our outlook because we didn't know anything. And what happened was that over the course of the next 12 to 15 months, we actually met up with Mr. LaRouche in the United States in the 1980s and got to know his political views, which is what I sort of elaborated so far. And in 1991, I actually met the organisation. I travelled to the US, met the organisation, and I met Mr. LaRouche in prison in 1994. 1993, actually, where he was actually jailed by George Bush at that time. Jailed because he was causing such a problem for the establishment in policies such as the Strategic Defense Initiative. Some people might know that as Star Wars. And policies that would have overturned the whole post-war, Cold War policy direction of mutually assured destruction and that sort of thing. So I brought Mr. LaRouche's policies back into Australia. Now, we're a sovereign political party. We adopt his ideas and we run it in the Australian context, but we're in very close dialogue, of course, with Mr. LaRouche's organisation in the United States.
All right, well, listen, we'll get back. We're going to go to a song there, Craig, and we'll come back. Citizens of the Electoral Council, interesting stuff. So if you could just hold on for us and then we'll come back and...
That's a toady... I come from the water.
We're talking to Craig from the Citizens Electoral Council.
Yep, that's right. Yeah.
From Melbourne. Craig, how's it going?
Good, thanks, mate. A bit wet down here today. It's pretty good.
Oh, it's pretty hot up here, mate.
we've had a cold October, but you're down in Melbourne.
Yep.
So the expansion of the Citizens Electoral Council, do you get a lot of flack from other groups, or that's what always happens?
What we've tended to do is stamp our own territory out in a lot of areas, and people don't want to have much to do with us because we're not a populist organisation. Mm-hmm. We stand for principle, mm-hmm. and particularly in the last 10 or 15 years, our main concern is that this world is governed by the global financial oligarchy, which is in another form called the British Empire.
City of London.
We attack the Queen and Prince Philip for actually who they are.
Yeah.
Rather than, and that's actually the cause of a lot of our problems, in that we haven't actually developed as a sovereign republic in this country. We've basically continued to be a self-governing colony with a lot of people just accepting that sort of autonomy as being the same as sovereignty, and it's not. And that was one of my big discussions with Mr. LaRouche back in 1993, where he said, the problem with Australians is you guys are happy to accept autonomy, but you're not sovereign. You don't have your own banking system, you don't have your own... you haven't broken the cords from England.
Well, I thought we had our own banking system until Hawke and Keating threw the Commonwealth Bank. I thought that was the People's Bank and threw it onto the stock market and floated it.
Well, there's only two countries in the world that have ever established a national bank. The first was, of course, under Alexander Hamilton, the first Treasury Secretary under George Washington,
mm-hmm.
who established a national bank in order to straighten out the finances of the 13 colonies at that point, because they were in massive debt. So he created a national bank to create the credit against the debt that was incurred by the colonies in order to rebuild the colonies out of the mess that they were in. The second was developed, and the 100th anniversary is coming up in very shortly, in December, of King O'Malley, who developed the Australian Commonwealth Bank. Now, he called himself, he was actually a Canadian who came into, or he might have been an American with Canadian citizenship, who came into Australia at the end of the 19th century, and he established the Commonwealth Bank on the model of the first US national bank. And that bank, Commonwealth Bank, although it wasn't, strictly speaking, 100% a national bank, it was able to take depositors' funds in And it built the Transcontinental Railroad. It purchased the Adelaide Steamship Company, which was used then for being able to supply Australia during World War One. It funded World War One. It purchased all the uniforms for World War One. It did an enormous amount of support for Australia during that war. Now, it showed the potential of what was possible if you created a national bank, and of course the City of London had to shut it down. So it was destroyed in about 1919, and since then it's just been dismembered right up until basically 1959 when they brought in the Federal Reserve,
central banking system.
The Reserve Bank.
The big problem, which is under the Crown of the City, and that's the problem. If, I remember the five axes of evil that George Bush said, and they never had Syria, Libya and all that, they never had any central banking systems. And when Libya was attacked, the rebels first put up the central banking system in one day. Which just shows. But there's one place called North Dakota, which does have a place that has a state bank. It's in America, and it's unbelievable that they have this because they put this legislation through. Because America's gone down the gurgler, it's got 0.9% unemployment in North Dakota because of this banking system they have, state bank. Which is interesting.
We used to have a series of state banks here in Australia as well. Like, for example, in the West, there was a Rural Industries Bank in West Australia. We had banks in Melbourne, banks of Bank of South Australia. There was various state banks because state banking is something that is allowed under our constitution, but not under the City of London's monetary system. So everything. And this is why we're moving into a very dangerous period. Right now, Jack, with this question of what's happening in the Middle East.
Yes, exactly. Iran.
Yeah, not just Iran, but Syria as well. Because what people have to understand is you can't just look at the world in isolated regions. You can't just look at Iran and say, "Oh, those nasty Islamic people who want to, you know, they want to create war." That's a complete fallacy. That's an argument put forward by the British monetarists because their system is breaking down. Now, a lot of our information on this comes directly from Mr. LaRouche, who has high-level contacts amongst Europe, Russia, Middle East, United States. The problem we have in the world today is that the entire transatlantic financial and monetary system, you know, centred at the moment around Greece, but also Italy, Ireland, Spain, and all these, the Portugal, and all these places, is disintegrating. The fact is that there's so much debt in the system, and this debt is all surrounded around a banking group called the Inter Alpha Group that was set up by Lord Jacob Rothschild in the 1970s. And it's basically the financial mechanism of the City of London. The problem is we have so much debt in the system, it's not able to be paid, and consequently, the mechanisms that are being found, like what's been found recently in Europe, using the European Stability Fund to basically create more money, $1 trillion, to create an insurance fund so that people can continue to lend money to these countries. It's just one great mess trying to solve a great mess. And, of course, what's at stake here in Greece right now is the sovereignty and the austerity. The sovereignty of the Greek people, are they going to be faced with massive austerity?
Well, they were going to have that referendum, which the people would have just went, no, we don't want to be bought by IMF, by the Rothschild dynasty.
Yeah, and the destruction of Europe is a reflection of the destruction of the international monetary system. On the contrary to that, what you have is China and Russia. Now, both these have a different Pacific natured outlook. Also, Argentina, ironically, down at the bottom of South America there, they have a different outlook. They have a different outlook towards development. I mean, China wants to, you know, go to the moon. It's developing space capacities. It's doing this in collaboration with Russia. There's enormous amount of collaboration between Russia and China in the Russian Far East and Siberia in order to develop that area. Mm. Now, they have a completely different outlook, and they also have a less destroyed economy. Mm. So you have two political regions in the world right now, where on one hand you have the smelling, rotting British system centred around the transatlantic countries of Europe, and you have the potential for more development around the China, India, Russia axis. Now, there's no way in the world the British Empire is going to allow the development of Russia and China and India and lose the global strategic power that those countries are building up. So what is happening is that you are seeing a festering, a build-up to World War III in the Middle East, where, for example, two-thirds of the US military fleet is now in the Mediterranean and the Indian Oceans in that region ready to be deployed. And this is like going to be a really hot situation, because you can't have that many military forces in that area for very long without something going off. Now, this, people say, well, how can that be? I mean, isn't Obama a decent guy? I mean, he's the first black president. Now, if people go to our website, you'll actually find that Obama is mad. He's insane. And Mr. LaRouche has been calling for the ouster of President Obama under the mental health provisions of the 25th Amendment of the US Constitution. The guy has what's called a narcissistic complex. Actually, there was a book by a guy by the name of Sam Vakunin, who's a psychiatrist.
Yep.
He's written a book called Malignant Self-Love, which goes through the dangers of Obama's psychology. And that, in a sense, he has a messianic type malignancy, you might call it, where if he is challenged, he doesn't care how many people he kills, he will just wipe them out. And this, there's various members of, there's various people in history that have had the same sort of complex, and one of those was, of course, Nero. That's why we call him Nero Obama. But Nero, for example, killed his mother, he killed his close friends. Whenever he got challenged, he just killed people. And when you look at the number of targeted assassinations that are taking place now in the US and the internal police apparatus that's being set up since the post-George Bush, since post-9/11, it gets to be quite worrying. And it's even getting to be more concerning that, you know, Obama didn't bat an eyelid when they used these drones to kill a 16-year-old American citizen in Syria. Was it Syria? No, it was Oman, I think it was, just a couple of weeks ago. And this is the sort of mentality you're dealing with a US president. This guy is a very dangerous guy to have in the White House, and therefore Mr. LaRouche is calling for his ouster. Obama is nothing but a tool for the British.
Second, I just wanted to ask you. I actually run a radio podcast called Truth News Radio Australia.
Mm-hmm.
I'd really love to get you on for an extended interview about some of these things. I'd like to get in touch with you. My name's Harold Benson.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in getting into more depth.
Okay. Yeah,
well, listen, Craig, we've got to wrap it up.
Okay.
Thanks for coming on. We'll have you back on. We can have you back on next week.
Yes, Jack,
talk
and Tom.
More about this really interesting stuff. Craig, thanks for coming on. Citizens of the Electoral Council. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Jack.
And we'll get you back next week.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
Awesome, mate. Thank you, mate.